Welcome to Language Access is No Vitamin, an essential podcast for those shaping the future of healthcare in America. Let's transform our healthcare system from seeing language access as an optional vitamin to the cure of patient-centered care. Welcome to Language Access is No Vitamin. Empecemos. Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Language Access is No Vitamin. My name is Joanna Tudela, and I am the host and your strategic partner for multicultural patient-centered care. Today, we have another very special episode with a guest. Today, we have my friend Vanessa Costa. And before we bring her in, I want to introduce you and tell you a little bit about all the amazing things she's doing. I cannot put all of that into a short bio, but I'm going to try my best. So Vanessa is the chair-elect of the Certification Commission for Healthcare Interpreters, serving as commissioner since 2020. She is the Senior Director of Quality for the Healthcare Interpreter Network, a collaborative of hospitals that share interpreting resources. Vanessa is a former director of the Multicultural Affairs and Patient Services at Cambridge Health Alliance, named number one in Massachusetts for health equity and community benefit by the Lawn Institute in 2021. She is former director of the Cross-Cultural Communication Institute at CCCS, Inc., and Vanessa has co-authored articles published by AMA Journals of Ethics and the Joint Commission Journal of Quality and Patient Safety. So please join me in welcome Ms. Vanessa Costa.
Hi, Joanna. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. You were one of the first people I thought about when I decided to start having guests into my podcast, because I remember the first time I met you, which was last year at the Atrium Interpreting Summit, and your presentation about, you know, using the LEP patient experience as part of, you know, understanding how the quality of the system is, including them in studies, including them into focus groups to really bring, you know, their knowledge, because among a lot of other things, they are really the experts of what's happening in the health facilities, because they are the patient, right? They're the ones getting the services. They know what works. They don't know what doesn't work. They've gone to other institutions. So really bringing them into the conversations, it is a game changer. So when I, you know, I decided to do a topic about this, I was like, I need to call Vanessa for this. So please tell me a little bit more about you. How did you get to be so involved in language justice and in the interpreting world?
So I chose healthcare interpretation as a first career, which is something that's actually quite rare. I'm a heritage speaker of Portuguese. I grew up in a multilingual home environment with a Luso-American dad and an Anglo-American mom who actually learned Portuguese in self-defense to understand things my grandmother was saying about her. And then that, so growing up, I used my languages in the community. It was initially an Azorean Portuguese community, and then gradually it became a Brazilian Portuguese community as the years went by and the immigration patterns changed. My husband is Brazilian. He immigrated as an adult and learned English as an adult, which is incredibly challenging. And we're trying to raise our son in a multicultural and multilingual home and community environment, the same way that I was raised.
I love that. And I didn't know that. I'm also Portuguese, so I didn't know we had that in common as well.
I love that.
And it's very hard because now I have a son too, and I'm trying to figure, because I also have Spanish, so I'm trying to figure out a balance between the English, Spanish, and Portuguese, little bit of everything. But I love that you're bringing that into your family as well.
Pursue them all with those three languages. He can go anywhere and do anything in his life.
Yeah, that's what I'm doing. My mom's taking care of the Portuguese. I take care of the Spanish, and, you know, we're working on that. So let's talk a little bit about, you know, the use of LEP patient experiences and bringing them into, you know, the healthcare centers and the infrastructure, and how can we, you know, what's happening with studies on the quality of and experiences of LEPs and communities.
Right. So what's happening with studies really depends on who conducts them and who funds them and where they're held. There really isn't enough research in language access and healthcare today. We need more researchers involved, and we need a better mix of funders, and we need more interpreters and patients involved in the research. But I'll tell you what the current studies have shown. So there are numerous studies that have demonstrated that patients who are unable to communicate in any majority language, not just English, are at greater risk of experiencing what we call suboptimal health outcomes. So language barriers have been associated with an increased risk of patient harm, longer hospital stays, higher likelihood of readmissions, compromised patient well-being, and then higher healthcare costs. And these studies aren't just centered in the U.S. These are global studies that are happening in many different countries, looking at, you know, limited proficiency in a majority language, which is often the immigrant and the refugee experience. So all of these consequences, they undermine the fundamental Hippocratic principle of first, do no harm, right? So we know that anywhere to provide equitable, safe, effective care for all patients, it's imperative to address language access in the fabric of the institution, not just on a case-by-case basis. So there are studies that have shown that in language concordant environments where patients and providers share a common language, patients do receive more information and they have the opportunity to ask more questions. And that can aid in achieving a diagnosis much, much sooner. There have been studies here in the U.S. because the U.S. is highly litigious. Everyone is suing everyone for everything. So given the litigious nature of the health system, clinicians who treat patients with whom they share a language, they report feeling less fear as clinicians, less fear of malpractice. Very interesting. And they report higher professional satisfaction in those interactions. So we know that like language concordance would be what we call a first-line health access strategy. But the average urban hospital serves more than 100 languages a year. So language concordance is not going to be possible. We will never have enough clinicians that are proficient and vetted to provide direct care in all of those languages. And so the engagement of nationally certified healthcare interpreters becomes what we call the next best just strategy in linguistically diverse populations.
I love what you're mentioning because I was just at the National Hispanic Hispanic Health Foundation and the National Hispanic Medical Association's summit last week. And one of the things that we discussed is like, yes, we want to do language concordance care. I mean, that's ideal. But really, in this case, we're talking about, you know, Latinos. We're looking at, you know, we're almost 20% of the population, but only 5% of providers are Spanish speaking. So really everything that we have to do, which we have to work towards, you know, increasing representation, absolutely. But really in order for us to bring that representation to, let's say, the ideal 20%, right? It's going to be very hard. It's going to take us a lot of time. It's going to take a lot of pipelines, a lot of infrastructure and systematic changes. So really, you know, we have to focus on the next best solution, which is, as you mentioned, language services, right? Interpreters and translators, because we still have to work with the 95% of providers that don't speak, in this case, Spanish, to really bridge that gap. So it's exactly that. It's like, it's a two-way. We have to, you know, increase representation of multilingual providers, multicultural providers, but we're never really going to get to a point that we're not going to need language services to bridge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I recently moved, well, in the past 2 years from Massachusetts to Florida. And here in South Florida, there are a lot of clinicians that have this idea that, well, we don't need interpreters because everyone speaks Spanish. And the reality is that most of the clinicians have not really been vetted for their language proficiency. So we don't know to what level they speak the language. But also in the community, it's not just Spanish speakers that require language assistance. When I walk through Walmart here in Sarasota, I hear Russian, I hear Ukrainian, I hear Brazilian Portuguese, I hear Haitian Creole. So no, we need a multi-pronged solution. So successful language equity interventions are always multi-pronged. And to build a culture of language justice in an institution, it really does require infrastructure, which requires a sustained effort and commitment from everyone, from the institutional leaders to the clinicians, to folks who need to be present in the organization designated to provide that consistent messaging and the education to the clinicians and to the communities around, you know, what are the policies that we need to be implementing? What are the best practices for intercultural communication? What does language access infrastructure need to look like here in this particular community? There have to be folks whose job it is to do that work in every healthcare institution. Otherwise, the work does not get done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you mentioned so many good things and so many good points that we definitely need to continue discussing. But I want to focus a little bit on, you know, how can health organizations bring in LEP patients to, you know, improve their language access? So tell me a little bit more about how we can, you know, increase LEP participation so they're a little bit more involved. Not only in, you know, going and getting care and their activities, but really more into a more in-depth participation, like focus groups, studies, you know, committees, eventually even, you know, board. Like, how can we bring the LEP experience into healthcare to improve language services and eventually outcomes, health outcomes?
So I've been personally inspired by reading an essay that was written by Andrea Escalera, and she is an immigrant activist, a heritage speaker of Spanish. She wrote an opinion piece in the Center for Health Progress blog, and you can find this online. And I want to quote her briefly. She said, "There can be no health justice without language justice. Our healthcare system continues to prioritize profits over people, and healthcare executives are padding their own pockets at the expense of our non-English speaking communities." And then she said, "We, as in we the communities, need to be the ones determining what meaningful access looks like." And that is just so powerful. And it really drives home that hospital-based language access programs, if they're really going to contribute towards health equity in a community, they have to be co-designed with the community. They have to be co-produced with the patients and the communities for which they exist to serve. Up at Cambridge Health Alliance, where I ran the language access program for 13 years, I had the privilege of learning from a colleague, Dr. Maren Batalden. She and her father, Dr. Paul Batalden, they're famous for pioneering the concept of co-production of health services. And one of the fundamentals of that is that we need to stop looking at healthcare as a product that is produced and consumed, but rather a service. And services differ from products because services are always co-produced between the service professionals and the service consumers. That co-production is what creates the experience. And when you think of, I know a lot of people don't like to think of patients as consumers because they're thinking of the specific Latin root in the term consumer, which means to destroy or to use up. And we associate consumerism with capitalism and give it a negative connotation. But there's actually another Latin root that underlies consumer, and it has a more positive connotation. It means to perfect or to complete. So when we think of patients as consumers using the second definition, by involving them in the design of our programs, they perfect the programs. They complete the programs, and we design something that truly is meaningful to the community for which it has been produced, right? So there's a wonderful article in the AMA Journal of Ethics, and it's written by doctors Pooja Tarakia and Brandon Combs. And they said, we need to view patients not as users and choosers, but as makers and shapers. And we need to plan with them and implement policies with them. And only in that way can we achieve better health outcomes. You know, and recent research has shown that nowhere in the U.S. have we achieved health equity, but everyone is striving towards it. We'll get there maybe faster if we involve the patients and the communities in the design of all programs, including language access programs. So how do we do that? It was your question.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not easy work, but there is a toolkit that has been created from 2014 to 2020. And this got overlooked a bit because of the pandemic hitting us in 2019. But the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, they convened an initiative called 100 Million Healthier Lives. And the whole point of that initiative, which ran for 6 years, was to help us transform our thinking around health, well-being, and equity. And it produced several products. One of those products was a toolkit called Engaging People with Lived Experiences. And you mentioned this earlier. The lived experience is extremely valuable. People with lived experience, simply by living and existing within our institutions and communities, they can help us close the gap between what we think is happening on the front lines of healthcare and what actually happens, or what should be happening and what the current practices are. And so we need to involve them as we think about redesign. So this toolkit, which you can access on the IHI.org website, it walks you through the process of identifying the people in the community with whom you need to connect, engaging them as individuals and small groups, offering fair compensation for their time and their knowledge, identifying who within this group would be well-positioned to actually come into the healthcare institution physically or virtually and participate with the design team and the redesign of whatever it is you're planning, and then preparing them and supporting them in that work. And the IHI also gives steps for, you know, how do you invest in the people with lived experiences, which really is an investment in your community, and provide them with training and skill building. So that in this process of collaborating on the redesign of your healthcare system or whatever quality improvement project you're working on, you're also building up their skills so that potentially some of them might become employees of your healthcare institution. And some of them might go on to have leadership positions in the community because of that experience that has built them up.
Yeah, and we see a lot of movement with bringing people with lived experience in the HIV world, right? And we have seen how that has really improved services, how it's really made changes in communities. We see it with, you know, we still have a lot of work to do, but, you know, reduced amount of HIV. We have improved medications and things like that. But really using people with HIV to be, you know, the patient navigators, to be the support system, the link coordinators. So really, you know, working with the community, because that lived experience, it's not something that we can just, you know, learn in school, right? Like, it's not something that it's really unique, and it's really a way of connecting, because I'd rather have, you know, talk to you, you know, as a mom, we can connect in a lot of different ways that, you know, if you were trying to give me advice of being a mom when you're not a mom, right? So those kind of things are that's what's key, what you're saying, really, to bring that experience into the table. And we see has worked with other models like the HIV prevention and treatment. So why not bring that into language access as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you bring up a really good point. Within the same organization, there might be groups that are working with people with lived experience on other improvement projects, but that work has never been done in building language access. And I think one of the most concerning trends in healthcare language access today is the trend towards, you know, eliminating, decimating the in-house hospital-based interpreter programs without any community consultation. There are major health systems in many states that have downsized or eliminated their in-house interpreter teams and outsourced their language access wholesale, usually to the lowest bidder. And the lowest bidder is usually a language service provider that's offshored a lot of its interpreter talent. And so they can pay interpreters less and therefore maybe charge hospitals less or maybe just pocket a bigger percentage of the profit. This is the reality of healthcare language access today. And usually patients are not involved in that process. And often patients are not even aware that these things have happened until they show up in the health system and find out, oh, we don't have staff interpreters anymore. We don't provide interpretation in person anymore. Here's a phone number we can call, or here's an iPad that we can use. And it's true. I think, you know, a robust language access program needs in-house staff and backup, right? You need all your modalities so that language access happens on demand at all touch points. You need your phone interpretation, your video interpretation. You also need your in-house language access advocates. And it really is the in-house interpreters that do that work of provider education, that are modeling best practices, that are walking through the health system and saying, that's concerning. We don't do that here. Or that's great. That's a best practice. Let's do more of that. They are the system of checks and balances. And when a hospital just eliminates eliminates its in-house program, it eliminates its advocates, it removes its system of checks and balances, and then who knows if those contracted language services are being implemented where they need to be and how they need to be. There isn't anyone monitoring it when you remove your in-house language access teams.
And you know what? I love what you're saying, and I'm actually going to, I was just looking for it. I'm actually going to quote yourself, because earlier today, I shared on my Instagram a post by the Certification Commission of Healthcare Interpreters where you are the one being quoted. So I'm going to read this out loud, because this morning I was like, yes, she is right. Let me share this. And now we're talking about it, right? So, you know, the post says, you say that, you know, when a health system dismantles its in-house language access infrastructure, language justice falls by the wayside, right? It's the staff interpreters in a health system that are its greatest language access advocate. So by you removing them, really, you know, you're removing the checks and balances. So I love that. And it just happened, you know, I went to, you know, tell you about this, and I'm like, oh, it's yourself. You're the one saying this thing. So tell me a little bit more about this, because this is a trend. We're moving into cheaper, faster, accordingly more efficient, because all you have to do is, you know, press the button, wait for the app to come up, and that's supposed to be faster than waiting for the interpreter to go from one place to the other in the hospital. But really, ideally, right, in the ideal world, we really want to see the in-person, in-house interpreter.
Yeah, I think a mix of modalities is always necessary. Yeah, not every touch point happens where everyone is in person. So you need to think about how do patients interact with your system? Is it online? Is it by phone? Is it by coming in person? And then you need to think about how do we build language access infrastructure for all of those touch points and involve the community in that conversation. What would make this easier for them? What would make this meaningful for them? And you're probably going to get a mix of responses that lead you to establish a multimodality program, where you do need all of the modalities and you do need your partners and vendors, but you also need your on-site presence. I'm going to give you a recent example. On Tuesday of this week, a hospital here in Florida laid off its entire interpreter team. The coordinator and 17 interpreters, half of which are Spanish interpreters and half of which are ASL. Within 24 hours, a deaf-blind patient appeared in the emergency room. And staff said, well, we don't have interpreters anymore, but we have this iPad. Now, how is that going to work for a deaf, blind patient? They need an in-person interpreter. They probably need tactile. There's lots of things they need that the hospital eliminated 24 hours prior. So the outcry from the deaf community has been very, very strong. We're not sure, though, if anyone has informed the other communities, the immigrant communities, those requiring services in a variety of languages other than English, and you know, if they don't get that information about what's going to be available moving forward, how will we know how they really feel about it? So I think that a lot of work has to be done, and I'm not sure who all the right people are to do it. I think that you're part of the solution, is to bring together hospital administrators, language access advocates, and immigrant organizations, immigrant advocacy organizations, so that we align around how do we get information to the communities, and also how do we bring the communities into the design, into the decision-making around what services are going to be available in the local health systems, in the local school systems, and in the court system or the legal system as well.
Yeah. So one of the things that we do as part of our assessment is we do, you know, focus groups. So normally I do at least 3 focus groups. I want to hear from the LEP communities, so the patients. Then I want to hear about the bilingual staff. I want to hear from them because, you know, a lot of the times we use them as interpreters, as, you know, providers, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to hear how they are, you know, how's language access within their organization. And that would include, you know, in-house interpreters, if they have it, or the coordinator, or whatever they might have. And then I want to hear from the non-bilingual providers. So I really want to hear from everybody and then put together the pieces. If there is an organization that wants to do something similar, right? They want to, you know, create a little focus group or a little, you know, survey or whatever it might be to hear from, you know, this community using language services. What would be some of the recommendations, the tips? You mentioned, you know, obviously pay them, right? We have to pay them not only for their time, but for their expertise, right? Because, yeah, bringing their own, So what else besides, you know, paying them and listening to them and bringing them to the table, what would be a few recommendations for any organization that wants to kind of, you know, explore this?
Years ago, I heard a presenter who was representing the Joint Commission that accredits hospitals. And she said, you know, the Joint Commission has an interest in language access, not just in the services available for your top requested language, but we also want to know what services are available for your third requested language. I thought that was such an interesting insight, because often we focus our resources on the majority minority language and don't offer the same menu to all the other language groups. And so I think that when you're doing focus groups, it would be important to identify, you know, what are not just the top requested language, or, you know, we have our deaf community and our Spanish speaking community, right? But what are the other language groups that exist, and where do we find them? And then you have to go out and build those relationships, and that can take time. Going out and finding the communities that are maybe not as well served as others within your institution, because their lived experience might be different from the lived experience of someone who is deaf or who speaks one of the majority minority languages, which of course is different from the experience of a hearing English speaking person. So you need to recognize that a variety of voices are needed. To bring them in, or even just to go out and find them, you need to work with people who are from the community and for the community, can be the bridge between your organization and those many different communities. And you need to make sure that language access is present in those conversations. I've seen successful and unsuccessful attempts to involve deaf, hard of hearing, and folks with limited English proficiency in patient family advisory groups, for example. And some of the things that determine whether it's successful or not have to do with how the meetings are scheduled, how language access is provided so that that person can fully participate in the way that a hearing English speaking person does, whether or not the interpreters also represent the organization, or if they're coming from outside the organization, maybe not with a full understanding of the culture of the organization. And then things like, what time is the meeting scheduled? Does attendance have to be in person, or is there a virtual option? Does this person have transportation? Are we providing childcare? Because if not, you're going to get a mix of maybe retirees and the independently wealthy, because working people are probably working during the hours that your hospital administrators are working. And for them to access these meetings, there have to be, you know, options around scheduling and options around modalities of participation and support to make this happen.
And I love what you're saying, because it's so true. Like, that's one of the things I always am like, okay, great. Well, I'm definitely going to have, you know, Spanish speaking, because 60%, you know, of the people are Spanish speaking. But what about the other ones? And I tell them, when we're talking about compliance, the law is very clear. We're not talking about a certain percentage that you need to have of a threshold for you to be like, oh, now I need an interpreter for this language. That doesn't exist. Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, the ACA, they're all very clear. Even if you only have one person that speaks one particular language, you have to provide them language services. That's simple. So it's not like, you know, we used to say before, like, oh, you know, 10% of a population, you should. Like, no, really, you will be liable if it's one person walking in. And that's where, you know, what you were talking earlier about having, you know, a mix of, you know, service, you know, providers and methodologies would work, because for those languages that are not very common, then that's where you're going to bring your video and your audio, your phone interpreters, right? And you're going to keep, you know, your insight for the most popular ones, but you still have to be able to provide those, you know, few, even if there's, you know, four or five patients that speak this language, you already know that your patients are established. You have to provide it. And you'll have enough time, because, you know, unless you take walk-ins, you'll know, you know, they're coming. So we got to make sure we find this, you know, Swahili interpreter, because we have, you know, this one family, but it's four of them. So things like that. So I very much appreciate what you're saying about, you know, thinking about that third and fourth language, not only your top two, for sure.
Yeah. And what you're able to offer might look different, and it might be provided by different certified or qualified interpreters, some in-house, some through your partners and vendors. But yes, you're absolutely right. The language access needs to be present at all touch points for all patients. Otherwise, they cannot meaningfully access their care. And you know, it's fundamental. We cannot make progress on the health equity front unless we have built these cultures of language justice in our institutions, and we cannot outsource that work. It's something that can only be built from within.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your expertise. You're, you know, be always such a good advocate for language justice. I love learning from you every time I see you talk or I see something in your post. I'm like, yes, I love it. I love it. I love the work, you know, that you're working with, you know, the certification and other organizations to really bring, you know, interpreting and translation language services as a whole, as people see it as a profession that it truly is, that it requires people that not only speak the language and understand the other culture, but they also have to be trained. They have to be certified. We need to make sure the quality that we're providing is up to par, because that's where we see a lot of, you know, errors and things that can go bad. So really, you know, advocating for everybody to see, you know, us as professionals and not just, oh, they just speak another language, come on over, whoever can do this, right? I love that.
I appreciate everything you're doing too, because as you told me before the start of the broadcast, as you talk about language access or language justice, you're encountering clinicians and healthcare workers who have never heard of these concepts. And that's in New Jersey, where the conversation has been going on for 25 years. And yet, there's been so much turnover in healthcare that the frontline workers and the administrators of today are not necessarily the same people that were having these conversations 5 years ago. So it's a message that we need to continually reinforce, and we need more voices saying the same thing so that we can make the same progress, and that progress can be consistent, you know, across, you know, health systems in the same geographic area, but also across states and regions within the country.
Absolutely, absolutely. So before we end today's episode, there's two things to do. The one, let's start with the question I ask everybody. So the podcast is called Language Access is No Violent, meaning that, you know, it's not a nice thing to have in your health organization, or you can just kind of like we do with vitamins, right? We take them, we're like, I'll skip it today because, you know, it won't hurt me right now. Language access is not that. It's not that nice to have. We are, you know, your ibuprofen, your Tylenol, your, you know, your aspirin. We're really here to solve, you know, the healthcare system and, you know, the many disparities that we see. So why is language access not a vitamin for you, Vanessa?
So I struggled with this one because I had to reassess how do I personally feel about vitamins? Before I could even begin to think of the question. But I guess what I would say is I would encourage healthcare organizations to reject any quick fix solutions, because just as a vitamin is no substitute for healthy living, establishing a vendor contract and outsourcing your language services wholesale is no substitute for co-producing and building a culture of language justice together with the communities that you exist to serve.
I love that. Thank you. Thank you. And before we end the episode, we're going to go with our little segment of Let's Debunk a Myth. All right. So today's myth is about providing language services. As like you're just mentioning, right? A lot of organizations think like, let me just hire this agency. We got your interpreters and your translators. We are good to go. We are compliant. We are fighting the fight for language justice. We're all in. So what do we think about this, Vanessa?
All right, I'm going to tell you a quick story about this one that will debunk the myth. So yeah, a lot of hospitals have a vendor, and therefore they think they've checked the box on language justice. Not a thing. When I moved to Florida, I took my son to establish care in a pediatric specialty facility because he has complex allergies. And in the intake, they always ask parents, what is your profession? I always identify as a healthcare interpreter, a nationally certified healthcare interpreter. And the nurse looked at me and she said, oh, honey, I wish we had those. This is a renowned pediatric specialty facility in Florida. And I said, well, what do you do when there's a parent who speaks another language? And she said, well, we call facilities and we ask them to bring us a phone. And then they bring us the phone and then we dial the number. And then she described this very arcane process. And you can imagine how inconvenient that is to the staff, how much it delays patient care, and how often it probably doesn't happen because of that inconvenience of it all. And I thought, you know, there's something better. And I began to tell her, you know, in Massachusetts, where I just came from, you know, hospitals have, for the most part, built a more robust system. There are interpreter phones on the walls, there are iPads in the clinic, there are staff interpreters in the hospital. You can decide with your patient which modality is going to be best and access it in a timely manner. Having a vendor and checking the box doesn't mean that language access is happening on the front lines.
Absolutely. You have to create that infrastructure from beginning to end. You have to think about the whole patient journey. That's another thing. It's not about the provider-patient interaction. It's everything that goes before and after, from walking into, you know, Googling your website and accessing there, being able to make an appointment, checking, you know, my chart and getting the information, you know, calling, sending messages to your doctor. I mean, everything within the patient journey, it has to be thought. And a lot of organizations don't think that. It's like, oh, well, the interpreter's here. When the doctor's here, it's like, well, okay. But yeah, we thought about all the barriers the patient had encountered to be here with you.
Absolutely.
Then they're going to continue to get their medication and coming back to the, you know, the x-ray and doing their lab. Like, all of these barriers are still in place. So it's really an infrastructure, like you're saying, a system that has to be implemented throughout the whole organization, not just like, there you go, I sign up with an organization, there you go, we're good to go.
Culture building takes time, it takes effort, it takes maintenance, and it takes designated individuals within the institution who are going to keep that culture alive.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Vanessa. I want to thank you very much for being here, for taking the time to share your knowledge and your experience. You did mention a lot of research, so I'm going to, you know, go get those links and make sure I post them in the comments, so everybody can, you know, access what you're mentioning to keep learning and continuing the conversations back in their organizations. So is there anything else you would like to say?
There is, actually. So I will send you some links that have been helpful to me, and also an article that I had the privilege of co-authoring with two amazing language access administrators, one from California and one from Florida, Marina Persolia Bell, who ran the language access program at Children's Hospital Stanford, and Prado Antolino, who runs the language access program at Moffitt Cancer Center in Tampa. We got together to write for the European Medical Writers Association. And the topic of the article was building language justice infrastructure. And we outlined a framework of pillars, services, people, processes, and technology that institutions need to put in place to hold up that infrastructure, to hold up that framework. And so I'm happy to share it with you and for you to share it with your audience. It doesn't have all the answers, but it has a lot of good questions. And if we all focus on the questions, we will build better infrastructure in all of our communities.
Absolutely. I'll be the first one reading it for sure as soon as I get it. So thank you so much. And thank you, everybody, for joining us. If you are watching us on Spotify or YouTube and want to get earlier access to our episodes, let's connect on LinkedIn. This is where we go live. And you can, you know, get the information before it reaches our Spotify and YouTube channels. Find Vanessa and me on LinkedIn. And we would love to keep talking about how we can support you and your organization improving language access. Again, my name is Joanna Tudela. I am your strategic partner for multicultural patient-centered care. And this was another episode of Language Access is Not a Vitamin. See you on the next episode. Thank you, Vanessa.
Thanks, Joanna.